It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's not how many hours you put in at the job or what time you're there. It's the results that matter. That's the philosophy of the results-oriented workplace. We'll hear how it works.
First, today is the seventh day of the ongoing conflict between Israel and Gaza. Yesterday morning, thousands of Palestinians fled northern Gaza after warnings from Israel's military that the area would be targeted with airstrikes. They defied suggestions from Hamas that they remain in their homes.
173 Palestinians have been killed as of this morning in the conflict. That's according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, with more than 1,200 wounded. Air raid sirens went off in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv last week, with Gaza missiles mostly landing in open areas or blocked by Israel's Iron Dome defense system. Yesterday, rockets fired badly wounded a 16-year-old in the Israeli city of Ashkelon. Joining us from the ground in Gaza is New York Times London Bureau Chief Steve Erlanger. We spoke with him earlier today. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So what is the atmosphere like today in Gaza City and northern Gaza?
Well, it was a fairly noisy night, but there were not any tragedies of the kind we've had over the last days. I mean, one wants to be careful saying that. But, you know, there was no incident of disabled people being killed or an extended family. People are being hurt and obviously dying. But the Israelis were mostly bombing Hamas training camps and rocket launching sites. The most interesting thing was their leafleting and telephoning the residents in northern Gaza around Beit Lahia, where a lot of the rockets are launched from, telling them to evacuate their homes because more strikes were coming in a large but temporary fashion. And that caused a sort of a panicked exodus more toward the south. Hamas had urged people to stay in their homes, saying this was propaganda from Israel, but many people left, and some of them waving white flags. They traveled by vehicles, by donkey carts, by foot, and sought refuge mostly in schools and buildings owned by the UN refugee agency that deals with the Palestinians called UNRWA. And about 20,000 Palestinians are now sheltering in UNRWA facilities.
The Hamas facilities, Israel has said it's difficult to avoid civilian casualties because these facilities are located in civilian areas near mosques, hospitals. Is that right? Are these rocket launching sites so close to civilian life?
Well, Gaza's pretty, I mean, it's not the most crowded place in the world, but there's a lot of people concentrated. There are big families in compounds. And yes, a lot of these rocket launchers are actually underground, and they're shot through slits in the ground, and they tend to be in open areas between buildings in which people live. They tend to be apartment buildings or three- or four-story houses. So you get this kind of, like, a lot between three or four houses under which rocket launchers are sometimes placed. And then the people who fire the launchers do it from underground, and they enter the tunnels through other houses. So the whole point, you know, it's a clever strategy, I mean, of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, is to try to disguise their launching places and to put them in the middle of crowded places because they know, you know, that Israelis' air force is going to try not to hit too many civilians. They hit enough as it is, but their intention is obviously to try to hit only combatants. The problem with war is you make mistakes, and it depends on how good your intelligence is, and the best kind of targeted killing sometimes goes wrong. And this is not to, you know, absolve anybody, but the fact is there really is an effort on the part of Israel not hit a lot of civilians, but they do.
And going the other way, there have been, I think, something in the neighborhood of 1,000 rockets launched toward Israel, many caught by the Iron Dome defense system, others inaccurate landing in unpopulated areas, evidently. What is life like on the Israeli side of this attack?
Well, there's a lot of stress and tension. I mean, it's very easy to look at Israel as this, you know, technologically advanced. I mean, compared to Gaza, I mean, it's like two different worlds, of course. You know, Israel has air defenses, it has air raid sirens, it has shelters, it has this Iron Dome anti-missile system. But, you know, from the warning until you get to the shelter, you may have 10, 15 seconds, 20 seconds. And it's not like you're going to get hit on the head, necessarily, but it creates havoc among civilian life. And schools get shut and open-air concerts get canceled. Neil Young had to cancel a concert because the army said there were too many people in an open space. So it creates a lot of tension. I mean, very few Israelis, by comparison, have been hurt. But the tension in southern Israel certainly is quite high, even if I wouldn't say it's quite as high as it is all through Gaza.
This is a conflict that it seems like both sides backed into. Nobody went in with a plan saying we want a military conflict. How did we get here from where we were just a couple months ago?
Well, it's kind of like the old joke in New Hampshire. You can't get there from here, you know. These things have a context. I mean, what got us here was first the failure, the collapse of the U.S.-sponsored peace talks. Israel then decided not to follow through on its promise to release another tranche of Palestinian prisoners. Then you had the horrible kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers who were hitchhiking home to their settlement. And Israel blamed Hamas in the West Bank for that kidnap and murder without giving much evidence, I have to say. It may be true, but they started to arrest a lot of people in the West Bank who are affiliated with Hamas. And they arrested a bunch of prisoners who they had released under a deal with Egypt and Hamas that got the release of the kidnapped Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Now, Egypt had promised that those people, once released, would not be rearrested, but Egypt's changed quite a lot lately. And so about 50 or so Hamas prisoners who'd been released under that earlier deal were rearrested. And then some rockets started being fired from Gaza, not by Hamas, but like a day later, Hamas fired a huge barrage toward Israel. I think it was Sunday, if I'm not wrong. And then Israel retaliated Monday and began this operation. So they kind of fell into it. It's nothing I think either side especially wanted, but it's worth saying that Hamas in Gaza feel very suffocated because the change in Egypt, the taking over by al-Sisi, what I consider a military coup, though he was sort of elected as president later. He's very anti-Hamas, anti-Muslim Brotherhood. He sealed the border with Gaza. He shut down the crossings. He shut down the tunnels. That starved Hamas of goods, of taxes. And Israel has also tightened its controls over the Gaza border after they had discovered a tunnel running into Israel by Hamas. So Hamas, feeling kind of isolated, has been going through this unity government with Fatah. This all gets very complicated, but they've got nothing out of that. Their employees in Gaza haven't been paid. Nobody's been paid in Gaza for like 2 or 3 months now. There's a banking problem. The ATM machines aren't working. There's a shortage of cash. And Hamas is feeling suffocated by, you know, Israel, blockaded by Egypt. The sea is patrolled by the Israelis. And I think Hamas is striking out to try to get a better deal, to try to, release some of the pressure on it by trying to push Israel into a negotiated ceasefire, which is, I think, is where we always will end up.
You've been reporting from Gaza. What kind of things are you hearing from Palestinian civilians, people not directly involved with Hamas?
Well, they're afraid, first of all, and they also feel very isolated. When you're in Gaza, you can't leave. I mean, nobody lets you leave and go anywhere. You know, you're in a way stateless. And if you're a male under the age of 35, it's very hard to get a permit to leave. Egyptians won't let you leave anymore, really. So you're stuck there. It's not like you can emigrate or, you know, get away. Hamas, you know, is not hugely popular, but it probably has, guessing, 25, 30, 40% support among the population. It was elected once, certainly. People do believe that Israel is at fault, that Israel is the aggressor, that it's important to resist what they call the occupation, partly in defense of the West Bank, which certainly is occupied, and partly because to be passive seems weak in the face of Israeli power. So there's a general support for this idea. But ordinary people want what ordinary people want everywhere, which is peace and, you know, a chance to make some money and to make their children's lives better. And they know this is not that. So there's a kind of quiet unhappiness with this and a feeling like we're in a bad movie being rerun again and people are dying. You know, lots of people are dying and they ask themselves for what particular reason might they be dying. But if you ask them directly, they're very reluctant to directly criticize Hamas.
And before I let you go, just briefly, one fear, there are apparently Israeli land forces massing on the border, a possibility of army raids to try to get to these Hamas rocket sites. How likely do you see that? How much of an escalation would that be then?
Well, Israel has a bunch of choices. There's a lot of pressure, particularly from the army and people. Actually, you know, pushing Netanyahu is actually fairly prudent about these things, pushing him to try to deal with Hamas once and for all, which in my view is impossible. They would advocate a big ground operation with air support to really clean Gaza of rocket launchers, blah, blah, blah. Because the rockets go so much farther, all of Gaza is a launching pad now. It's not just northern Gaza. Israel used to go to northern Gaza and do some of these operations, but now, and they've always been afraid or reluctant, certainly, to go into the big cities and fight. It's a very bad way to fight, and you end up losing lots of soldiers and lots of civilians die. And, I just don't think the West is going to tolerate that much bloodshed. So part of the Israeli massing on the border is, you know, psychological, to prove to Hamas that this is serious and that Hamas should come to terms and negotiate something that stops the rocket fire for a long period of time, not just for 9 months or a year. But Israel also has the option of doing limited incursions, staying out of the big cities, and just particularly in the north and around Rafah, on the Egyptian border where a lot of rockets are, to go and try to go in on the ground and clean out some of those, to pull Hamas into actually fighting, and to punish Hamas and kill as many as possible. That's the debate going on in Israel. Well, for Hamas, the military wing seems to be in control right now because the political leaders, you can't find them in Gaza. They're underground. They're not answering their phones. They're, you know, don't want to kill themselves. Israel has said that they will target them. So, you know, we're moving, I think, toward a ceasefire, but it is always possible that the Israeli government will decide to throw the dice.
Stephen, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very, very much.
We spoke with New York Times London Bureau Chief Stephen Erlanger earlier today. He joined us from Gaza.
How many hours do you clock at the office? Many of us put in 40 hours per week, if not more.
Although we're present in the office, the fact is we may not be as productive as we could be, and that's leading one Swedish city to try something different, let people work 6-hour workdays.
In this experiment, one group of municipal employees will work a shortened schedule, while another group maintains its 40-hour week. While it's too soon to say whether what they'll conclude from this experiment, our next guest says changing the way we measure our work output could actually do wonders in increasing focus and productivity. Jody Thompson is the co-founder of CultureRx and co-creator of the Results Only Work Environment. Jody, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Cynthia. It's great to be here today.
Well, first, let's define what a results-only work environment looks like.
Well, first of all, a results-only work environment is the new flexibility model. And what they're talking about in Sweden is really the old flexibility model, where we're talking about shifting our time. In the new flexibility model, we're really talking about the equal balance of autonomy and accountability, where we're not really talking about time at all, but we're talking about people having complete control over all of their time and focusing on results. So what is it that I need to achieve for the organization? And let's just forget about the time and let me control that and control the place and the time that I work and give the results to the company. That's what I should be measured on, not time and place.
Why do you believe that that would be the more ideal approach to work?
Well, because people right now are in that catch-22 of really, who's my master? Am I a master to the clock and the place? And they're, you know, in a paternalistic type of environment. So I'm asking permission of my boss. And my focus is really, where am I working from? And can I get some time off? Or can I get permission to work from another location? So what we're really focused on is time off. And, you know, like, where do I get to work from? I'm not focused on the actual work. We're finding that people really don't understand what the work is. And so we're not looking at work in the right way. What we really need to do is get clear on what is the work and what am I really measuring and what is my value to the organization. And it gives people more purpose. What am I really doing? What am I getting up every day and to do? And really focus on that, not, you know, can I get some more time off, or is the boss going to be, you know, able to give me the ability to leave early today? It's the wrong focus.
Let's dig into that just a little bit, because as you've said, the new workplace flexibility depends on managing the work and not the people. But the two seem to be so intertwined, or at least, you know, I guess in the old model, that's what we've been led to believe. So how can a boss, for example, manage the work and not necessarily the person behind it?
Well, what's interesting about that is, first of all, we all have to get clear on what the work really is. And what we're learning, Cynthia, is people don't know what the work is. So let's say I go to my boss and I say, is it okay if I leave early today? Well, can you? I mean, what's the work look like? So what the manager needs to do is shift the conversation to the work. Conversations about work should be objective, not subjective. And when you're talking about where somebody's working from or where they can, if they can leave early, that's not relevant to the work. Shift the conversation to the work. Talk about the measures of the work, the project, the deadlines. Let's talk about the real work. Can I leave early? Has nothing to do with the work. Nothing.
Okay, so walk me through that conversation. If you were the boss in that scenario, how would you redirect the conversation?
So can I leave early today? Let's talk about the project and how you're doing. Let's talk about where you're at with the project today, Lynn. Tell me about that. Okay. So it's just as simple as switching that around. Let's talk about the deliverables for next week. Are we on track? So just switching that to the objective instead of the subjective, which is, can I leave early?
So how do you ensure dependability and accountability under this system? I mean, the employee might say, okay, I'm going to go work on that project now. And then they, you know, head to the beach and go swimming. I don't know.
Sounds like fun to me, Cynthia.
Yeah.
Well, what's so interesting about that is oftentimes We don't hold people accountable to results. And so that's the other side. That's the equal balance, autonomy and accountability. And we find in organizations that people are not held accountable to results. So when they don't deliver results, it's still okay because, gee, they put in their time, right? So we are paying them for the time they put in, the 40 hours. So what we have to do is make sure the flip side is accountability. If you're not delivering results, then no job. And so everybody has to be held accountable to results. If you're not delivering, then that's where performance management comes in. So in a results-only work environment, it's interesting. When everybody is held accountable to results, people start stepping up to the plate because they understand what the bottom line is, because managers become results coaches. They're not managing my time anymore.
Jody will pick that up after the news. We're talking with Jody Thompson, co-founder of Culture RX and co-creator of the Results Only Work Environment, about how to reconsider the way we measure our productivity at work.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about this idea you're hearing? How would this work at your workplace? Or do you want to ask how it could be put into place at your workplace? Would you rather work on a flexible schedule that maybe allows you to focus on the job rather than worrying about being there from 8 to 4 or 9 to 5? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Right now, we're talking with Jody Thompson, co-founder of Culture RX and co-creator of the Results Only Work Environment. The story so far: forget the clock, forget how long you're sitting at your desk, and measure results at the workplace, not time spent.
And we'd like to for you to weigh in on this concept as well. Would reducing the number of hours that you work help your productivity? How do you feel about the idea of a more flexible schedule and a results-only based workplace? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also comment at the Central Time Facebook page. And Jody, just before the news, I cut you off midstream there. You're talking about how in order for this system to really work, the other half of the equation is to be accountable to the results. Why don't you expand on that just a bit?
That's right. I think people tell us all the time, we hear this, they say, boy, it's just really hard to, you know, fire people around here. And everybody knows it too. You know, in your workplaces, you say, oh, there's just people that are, we just know they're not getting anything done. They're just coming in every day and they're sitting around. And it's so frustrating to us because the rest of us are doing all the work. We hear that all the time. And that's because we're using the time clock as a measure of work. And we're saying, if you put in your time, we'll give you a paycheck. And what we have to do is we have to flip that. We have to say, what is the work? And we're going to measure you on that. We're going to pay you for results. What is it that you're going to deliver? And we're going to get really clear on that. So when you say to somebody, we're going to reduce your hours, we're going to say, okay, we're going to do an experiment. You're going to do 6 hours a day. You're already starting out on the wrong, with the wrong measure. Because now people are going to do 6 hours, but they still don't understand what is it that I'm delivering and what is it that you're going to measure me on in terms of the results of the work. So people can still just put in time, right, and get a paycheck.
Let's take a call from Joe in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Joe.
Hi. See, I think a lot of these discussions are based on office environment. I've spent 30 years in residential construction, and a lot of this is, are your duties dependent on others? You know, how long should it take? Will the weather be there? Will the concrete show up? You know, and the whole concept of the crew. And I think a lot of this needs to be, it might work well when everyone is online, per se, and you can be monitored. But in the open environment with physical labor, it's problematic. It creates kind of a management nightmare.
Yeah, good point, Joe. Is it possible to apply this type of work environment to all fields, Jody?
Well, I'm glad Joe called in because, yes, we actually have been in lots of environments where people are location-specific, Joe. So we've actually done this in manufacturing plants, direct care nursing, child care, retail, so all sorts of location-specific jobs. So results-only work environment, like I said, is accountability and autonomy. So what that means is I have to understand what the outcome of the work is, and I have to deliver that outcome. So there's a lot of things that come into play, like you said. So there's other people I have to depend on, and there's other things that can come into play. But I have to understand what the delivery is in terms of the customer outcome. I still have to make that happen with all of these other things that come into play. So the things that are important are communication among team members. I have to make sure that I'm, understanding all the moving parts and everything that's happening. The manager is still a results coach. I still have to be overseeing what the work is. But what often happens with people is they become complacent when the manager is doling out orders. They don't communicate with each other because they're waiting for the manager to orchestrate everything. In a results-only work environment, the people, when they become responsible for the outcome, they communicate better with each other. And when they run into issues, they come to the results coach to help them solve problems. So it becomes a different kind of platform in terms of how people work together. The manager isn't so much of a puppet master anymore, trying to figure out how to tell people how to do things. The manager is more of a, like I said, results coach. People take more responsibility to make sure that they're in the right place at the right time to get the customer outcome.
You know, I could see a scenario, Joe's call reminded me of this, in a job where the work isn't done until the project is over. So in construction, this project isn't done until the building is built. And if given that the amount of work might exceed the amount of time allotted per day, and one has the flexibility to, quote unquote, choose when they're going to work, they could wind up in a work environment where they're working all day. And maybe entrepreneurs find this as well as they're trying to run their own business.
That's true. And really thinking about a day in different ways. So sometimes somebody might say, well, I want to control how my workers work or how late they work or how long they work or when they work because I want to take care of them. We've heard that often too. I want to take care of them so they don't overwork or whatever that looks like. Instead, people can manage their own effort and their own time, and oftentimes they do better work and they deliver things more timely if we let them manage this on their own. So we've seen that over and over and over again on teams. They actually deliver things quicker and they make deadlines happen sooner if they're allowed to manage this on their own. Sometimes managers will step in with preconceived notions about people's energy, and they actually get in the way of how teams can manage this on their own.
Let's take a call next from Bob in Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hi. I think that the young lady is really talking about something that can be very good, but is also highly inflexible. She's really talking about a world that's more manufacturing. I have a business that where we manage money, and we need to have people there answering phones, fielding projects and what have you. Things are very entrepreneurial. Myself and the two people who work with me, and note the word I'm using, work with me, do projects based upon when the work comes on in, and also what we have to do when we're talking to people. It's not something, I start work at about 6:30 in the morning, but the markets open up at about 8:30. And from 8:30 till about 3, we need to have people manning our offices all the time. It's not something that we have enough flexibility to go out with. This is kind of the new world. It's not the old world of manufacturing, which is good. In which some of this might work, but it certainly wouldn't work in my business.
Jody, what's your response?
Yep, and what Bob is saying is right. Not every organization is ready for the new flexibility. The new flexibility is, he's right, it's the future, and not every business is ready for that yet. Every business will eventually move into the new flexibility. But there's only certain businesses that are going to be ready for that today. It takes a certain kind of leadership constitution to move into the new flexibility. The rest of organizations across the globe are going to stay in the old flexibility model for quite a while, but there's going to be organizations, just like in any global change, that are going to lead the rest of the world. And those organizations are going to be moving into the new flexibility model. And those organizations are going to be for many types of businesses. They are going to be manufacturing, office workers, you know, retail, all walks of any kind of job. But it does take a certain kind of leadership to be able to lead and be first movers in this kind of flexibility. So he's right. Not everybody's ready for this. And our organization, CultureRx, GoRow.com, we're looking for those organizations that are ready for this type of new flexibility.
And one last call from Molly in Milwaukee. Hi, Molly. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just basically listening to the show, I'm just realizing that I recently switched from a very hours-based work environment to a results-based work environment. And without knowing the term, all I could really put my finger on was that I worked really well in one, and I really didn't work well in my previous environment. And I think it has to do with somewhat the job that I'm doing. I agree with the previous caller that with certain financial markets, you need to be available at certain hours of the day, but the job that I have right now, it feels much more natural for somebody to expect a certain result of me than for me to just basically show up and, you know, be a warm body in a space for a certain number of hours. It has never jived with me.
Well, thank you, Molly, for that call. And Jody, you know, going forward, a lot of businesses might think this is a nice concept and maybe the employees around here would be happier, more fulfilled if they were just given the flexibility to work when they want to. But it also seems like a big undertaking and a massive culture change. What's one small step that a business might consider implementing right now to make it happen?
Well, I think the first thing that businesses have to do, like I said, is they have to really step back and start thinking about, does every single person in my organization really understand what the work is that they were hired to do, and do they know how to measure results? And it doesn't matter what the job is. Don't cop out. I'm a knowledge worker. You really can't measure, you know, my results. No, every single person should be able to measure the value that they add to the organization. That's a good place to start.
Well, Jody, thank you so much for giving us something to think about.
Thank you.
That was Jody Thompson, co-founder of CultureRx and co-creator of the Results Only Work Environment.
It's time for a Wisconsin Life, and today we're talking about home. Ann Peters' architect father designed and built her childhood home north of Fond du Lac. Everything about that house came to define her sense of place and what home means. And we want to hear from you, too.
What does home mean to you? How do you define it? How do you know when you're there? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls and comments right after we hear this story from Ann Peters.
There are people who define their lives by the places where they live. I am, and there's no mistaking it, one of them. We fixate on rooms and their arrangements. On the book report, we can't see the difference between setting and plot, between the landscape and the characters in it. For me, the house my architect father built in eastern Wisconsin in the early 1970s is the line drawing beside the word house in the dictionary. 20 miles north of the town of Fond du Lac, the house was backed into a hill, the Niagara Escarpment, what we locals call the ledge. At the front, a wall of glass and a descending view. A field, a farm, another field, and then the lake. The children's rooms were in the back, and they smelled like a cave. Packed dirt, cold stone. Monk cells with a single bed and a built-in desk and bookshelf, the rooms were designed, my father said, to resemble the dormitory room where he'd been so happy as a young man. Every morning, I'd leave my room and walk down a narrow hallway, and in that walk out to the rest of the house, I moved from darkness to light, constriction to expanse. At the end of the hallway, you stood on a promontory, looking down over the living room open 30 feet to the ceiling. My father designed the skylights to catch the morning sun over the top of the ledge. 6 stairs down, and you were in that light, looking down again through the living room to woods, lawn, field, farm, and lake. There were no curtains. I sometimes say that the house raised me as much as my parents did. From the layout, I learned how the self can change size. how at night in the bedroom I grew to fit space, pulsing and ungainly, like Alice squeezed inside a rabbit hole. From the view and the progress to it, down and out, from small room to larger ones, from the ledge to the lake, I internalized a narrative of daily drama. You felt as if every day you could be remade. I've been happy in the places I've lived since leaving Wisconsin at 18, but I've never felt quite at ease. It's as if the last 25 years have been one long slumber party, and I, stiff on the rollaway, must keep one eye open for morning, listen for a rescuing honk in the driveway from the car that will take me home. On the night of 9/11, when others were staring numb at the television screen, my sister and I comforted ourselves by recounting every detail we could remember of the house in Wisconsin. We sat on my couch in Brooklyn, beer bottles sweating in our grip, and walked through each room, looked out every window, until finally, in our minds, we separately and silently closed our bedroom doors. My parents sold the house long ago, but some days, as I step out the front door of my New York apartment building, I half expect to see before me the rafters and the skylights of our living room, still expect to feel a narrow hallway opening out to the light and space of a Wisconsin morning.
Ann Peters is the author of Household, A Memoir of Place, and is Associate Professor of English at Stern College at Yeshiva University. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. You can catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Mondays at 8 p.m. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org or look for Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
We heard her thoughts on home. Now we want to hear from you. What does home look like to you? What does it mean? How do you define it? How do you know when you're there? And how has your idea of home changed through the years? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Jeff on the line in Black River Falls. Jeff, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you think? What does home mean to you?
Home for me is something kind of interesting for what I'm doing right now. My parents are moving from my childhood home to another home near. Mm-hmm. And I'm from Black River Falls, a very small town. So everything that I know will be kind of different in where I go to go home. I go to the University of Stevens Point, and so when I come home, I would take the same route. Mm-hmm. I go through the same places and everything. And now, with them moving, I won't be in the same place anymore. I won't take the same route home anymore. And I think that that's kind of different and strange.
Well, it's going to be an interesting test, Jeff, because maybe it'll turn out you miss that old route in the old place, or maybe it's the people who are there when you get there.
Right. I know. I that's what I was kind of thinking. Like, I will naturally probably go the wrong way to go home, like take old routes and then kind of snap out of it and realize where I am and realize that that house that I grew up in is no longer home.
Jeff, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. I went through a similar thing when my parents moved out of the house I grew up in and mm-hmm. thought, oh, I'm going to miss that. And, you know, one visit to the new place later and yeah, wasn't a big deal, it turned out.
You adjusted. I wonder, as we go on through our life, if we become less attached to those types of things.
The physical structure.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a call next from Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen.
Well, I think I'm continuing on the same theme. I just sold my house, and I'm living in, I'm not really sure exactly where I'm going. And I've really kind of come over years and years and years to realize that home really rests pretty deeply in me and who I'm most connected with, you know, at the time. And I thought it would be a little traumatic to sell my home that I've been in for 30 years, you know, until my husband died. And I just, you know, it's not my home. And, you know, and it's really funny to just recognize that all of a sudden one time and just realize that your home is really has to be inside of you and with the people that you care about. So I think that's again, as you get older, I think you kind of come to realize those things.
Yeah. Thank you, Ellen, for those comments. That's a nice thought. Home rests with us. Marsha on Facebook also submitted her thoughts. She said, I have several homes. One is in Duluth, Minnesota, where I spent three of the best, most fun and carefree years of my life. I wasn't born there, and it was the shortest time I've spent anywhere in my life, but it's still home to me. My other home is the tiny town where I was born and attended a four-room schoolhouse as a small child. Finally, my other home is wherever I am with my husband. Hopefully my children will always be near this home as well. Thanks for that, Marsha.
And we're taking your calls on what home means to you at 800-642-1234. We go now to Jeanette with us in Warren, Illinois. Jeanette, hi.
Hi there. I'm back home in the Upper Mississippi region in the Upper Midwest after spending 15 years out west, and home was basically changing every 4 to 6 months as I worked at a new park job. But home always called to me back in this region, and there's just something very special about the Mississippi River, the Turkey River, the parts in northeast Iowa, and home has changed recently. I got married 5 years ago, and my husband's home is Eastern Joe Davies County in Illinois, and home reflects a lot with the people, but the land, not just houses, the land means a whole lot to me.
And Jeanette, when you were out west, when you said, I'm going home, or when you came back to Illinois, did you call it going home?
Yeah, when I actually was going back to northeast Iowa, yeah, going back to northeast Iowa is home, because that's where I'm originally from, and it was strange to be uprooted two and sometimes four times a year after growing up on my family's ancestral farm that dates back to the 1840s. And before I was 18, I had never lived anywhere else.
Wow. Well, Jeanette, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story.
Mm-hmm. And we'll take a call from Keith in Little Chute. Hi, Keith.
Hello. Yes, home to me is a couple different things. First of all, my parents live in southern Juneau County in the hills. And they live on the family farm that my great-grandfather had. And so that's home there. But also home is my family here in Little Chute. I love coming home to my wife and kids. And that's home to me, too.
Keith, that's so nice to hear. We've got lots of comments coming in as well on the Facebook page if we want to continue the conversation.
That's right. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and share your thoughts, your answers to the question, what does home mean to you? What do you mean when you say you're going home? Interested to see your thoughts there. And thanks so much to all of you who called in as well.